Jen Smith is one of the hosts on the Frugal Friends podcast. Jen and her husband paid off $78,000 of debt in about 2 years, and they bought a house on a combined income of less than $90,000 per year. Jen didn't want to change her spending to pay off debt and opted for side hustles instead. She quickly took on so many side hustles that she contracted shingles due to stress. And one of Jen's side hustles was designing t-shirts and then selling them on Amazon. She was actually featured on Money Magazine for that. So the shingles episode led her to try a no-spend challenge to control her spending. The experience was so life-changing that she wrote a book about it, and it has over 2,000 reviews over on Amazon. And this is pretty interesting. She feels personally victimized by budgets, doesn't make one, and tells others that they don't have to either, which I'm not a huge fan of budgets myself. So today we talk about a new book that is out that she and her podcast partner Jill wrote. It's called Buy What You Love Without Going Broke. So we talk about the book, we talk about the process of writing the book, and one little nugget that I'll tell you about is the sound check is us talking about how I don't like interviewing authors about their books. And I explain why, and I don't know, I think it's a mixed bag out there. Some people like that. They like to have authors on like 20 different podcasts. I don't really like it that much. So anyway, we talk about that in the sound check, so be sure to check that out at the end. I do want to give a couple kind of little plugs here. So number one, Mint Mobile. I've been talking about them for a little while now, a few weeks at least, and I moved over to Mint Mobile a little over a year ago, and I tested it out. It worked great. It was a fraction of the cost of what I was paying at one of the bigger cell phone companies, and it worked fine. So I got my wife to move over as well. So we ended up saving quite a bit of money because we're only paying about $15 per month each to get 5 gigs of data, and the service is fantastic. So definitely worth checking out if you're on one of the big companies. Mint Mobile is great. And the other thing is, I don't talk about it enough, but we have an email list, the Mile High Fi Club, and I send out one email per week, usually letting you know about an episode and just maybe some other stuff that is going on. So if you're interested in getting that email, you can go and sign up. There'll be a link in the description, and I think it's milehighfi.club. milehighfi.club. You can go there. And the last thing I'll mention is the Facebook group. It's a small, tight-knit community there. I don't spend too much time in there. I'm trying, but Facebook just kind of sucks me down, and I don't enjoy it. I spend too much time there if I go. Very distracting. But anyway, other people seem to like it really well. So you can go to milehighfi.com/Facebook if you want to check it out over there. And let's go ahead and get to the interview with Jen Smith. All right, Jen, great to have you on. Good to see you again. And a lot of times I open up and I mention like how we met, and we were at FinCon, and I can't remember exactly where or when we bumped into each other, but we ended up hanging out in the same group at least one or two nights, which I got to know you pretty well then. So when I heard you had the book coming out, I was like, this is cool. But we actually don't know each other super well. And while I've seen your show out there, I've only listened to like one or two episodes. So I think it'll be great to get to know you. And I actually want to just hear like, what's your background? How'd you get into personal finance and this sort of creator and broadcasting space?
Yeah, you were part of some of my favorite memories from this last FinCon, because I still think about that $22 espresso martini I got at the Ritz and how it was worth every penny all day long. But so yeah, I'm the co-host of the Frugal Friends podcast. And I got into frugality. Well, I got into personal finance while my husband and I were paying off $78,000 of debt and doing it really fast, like a lot of people who pay off debt tend to do. And then I got to the other side and I was like, this is going to solve all my financial problems. I should be okay now. And I wasn't. So I was like, okay, clearly I need to just hop into the next goal, financial goal, which is financial independence. So I started saving probably around 50 to 60% of our household income. And we did that for about a year. And then while we were on that journey is when the podcast started. But about a year into this, I got laid off from my job, and it was about 7 or 8 weeks before I gave birth to my first son. And so that was the huge turning point for me. So I had already, the debt payoff had led me to writing about personal finance. That's what my full-time job was at the time. And I was interviewing all kinds of people in the FI community. That I, it was just like a dream life. Like I was pursuing FI. I was hearing all of these stories. And then it all came to an abrupt halt because I lost my income and I couldn't pursue another one for the time being. And it forced me to take a look at what was behind my financial goals, what was behind my fear of spending, and why I felt like I needed to hoard money, or why I felt like I needed to be financially like at the very top, or whatever the top meant to me. And that's where Frugal Friends kind of evolved from this podcast to help people save money on all kinds of things, to help people spend money and say no to things that they don't value, to learn the difference, to help overspenders stop spending on things that they don't need, and hoarders start to be able to spend without guilt and shame.
And the $78,000 of debt, where did that come from? Because it sounds like you have, or at least right now, you have a strong, you know what you want to spend money on. Like, you know what you value. Obviously, you wrote a book on it, right? So what was that $78,000? Where did that come from?
It was mostly student loans. So it wasn't like it was consumer spending. I had beforehand, before I ever met my husband, I had like $2,000 of credit card debt because my parents never had credit cards. And I felt like they were, you know, financially illiterate. And to build credit, you needed a credit card. So I got one and I immediately maxed it out. And the way I paid that off was I got rear-ended in a parking lot and I got $2,000 from my insurance. So that was my first debt payoff story. Yeah. But the big part, right? The big part was just student loans. So I had all this guilt about being in debt because debt is bad and, you know, people in debt are irresponsible, which is what I was being told. But it was a good thing for me to go into debt. Like, it gave me the opportunity to like pursue a career that I wanted, and then paying off that career pursuit led me into the career that I am in now. So I had a lot of like come to Jesus moments during the debt payoff of like, my husband's debt was mostly student loans too. So yeah, it wasn't consumer, but it still really like messed with my mind just because of what I had been traditionally told about debt and the type of people who are in debt.
So most of the audience were sort of like on the more advanced side of like FIRE. So either early retired already or getting close to it, or at least more advanced. So can you share how the principles of buy what you love, that's the name of the book, right? How those value-based spending ideas could be applied to the stage of life where it opens up, and maybe this will lead to some other questions, but some of us are more like on the hoarder side where we saved maybe a little too much. Many of our projections are really conservative. So we've accidentally saved too much and find ourselves, it's a weird problem, but we find ourselves under budget where we actually need to, you know, figure out how to spend money effectively. So how do some of the ideas of the book help us out?
Yeah, I found that when I started looking at my spending, and the reason that I was hoarding money is because I felt guilty every time I spent money. Even if I had put money in the budget for the thing, if it wasn't the most optimal or efficient place to be putting my money, like I would still feel guilty, which is part of my apprehension towards, you know, the idea that every single person needs a budget, because budgets just made me feel more guilty about spending money. So I think I had to dig into that and figure out where that fear was coming from, and really like a fear of not having money. And I think that's so like common in the FI community. So like, how do we get that? How do we get at that fear? And I've really found like looking at the surface, looking at this spending and figuring out, okay, how do I just get comfortable with spending money and then also spending it without going broke? So like the title of our book is kind of for, it's a little tongue in cheek, right? So it's for people who want to spend money on everything and need to rein it in. But I think it's so applicable for FI because every time I spent money, I felt like I was going to go broke if I spent it. And so it's 100% applicable for the FI community too. And that came to, I have to figure out that money isn't my only resource. So frugality, we see it just in terms of money. It has become a lot of times a spending race to the bottom. How can I want as little as possible? And how can I get as much for as little as possible? And really reframing it to be, actually, how can I be most efficient and steward well all of my resources, all my limited resources? And yes, money is one of those, but time is another. So much of FI is optimizing money so that we get more time, but time in what season of our lives? Because seasons change and we may want more time now than in the future, but we don't know that. So where do we optimize our time, our natural resources, thinking like in the future, our physical spaces? So yes, I mean, a little bit of minimalism plays into that, but also having a home that you feel is beautiful and that you want to invite people over to. And then also our mental energy and making sure that our thoughts and our overthinking and overanalyzing and scheduling and all of these things that I feel like I was really like filling myself with in all these projections, just like, you know, running 25x calculations all the time, making sure that we are strategic in that and we have mental space for other things and people in our lives as well.
I know for me, very similar to what you mentioned, where even if we have a line item, feels like I shouldn't be spending it because of those habits that we've had for like many years, or, you know, maybe we made a mistake in that area, but now it's opened up and we can actually spend a little more. Do you have any specific examples from your life, your family, where you've maybe tested something in the last couple of years where you're like, can we buy back some time with this? And this is a good value, even though it's maybe a more luxurious experience than what you're used to, or what, just to test it. So do you have any examples like that?
I'll give two examples. One's a really obvious one. And then one I say a lot on our show, but I think it's like the most applicable. So the first, like for us, is like house cleaning. So if I have enough room in our budget in the certain season, and it doesn't have to be all the time, but in a certain season where I can pay somebody to just like clean my bathrooms so that I don't have to stress about it and I can do things on the weekend, like that's buying back my time in the current. And it's just like an investment. Like I want to have time in the future, but I also want to have time now. So I view it as an investment. It's also an investment in like local communities, local service providers, keeping more money in the community. So it's like an investment all around. The other one I think that I use more often and was really the impetus for like writing the book and really for values-based spending in general is coffee shops. And this isn't in my current season, but like when I was first trying to figure this out before I had kids, coffee is always like a big thing for me. I love it. And I felt guilty every time I got a cup of coffee, even though like it was one of those things I valued and put in my budget. So my mission was like, okay, why do I feel guilty? And how can I give this like a different meaning so that I can get what I love? Because it's just a thing, right? And I found that when I was going to get coffee with friends, I really enjoyed that more than getting coffee from the Starbucks drive-thru. When I looked back at my transactions, the ones I could remember are the ones that were attached to people. And the ones I couldn't remember are the ones that just were habitual. So that really was the inspiration for how we got to values-based spending, is that we are always, we are spending to get more of our values, and not like the corporate values that you see like on businesses, like integrity, courage, all those corporate values that I'm sure everyone listening is like really familiar with, but that are essentially human needs that are found on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We're spending to get these things. So if we look at those things first and figure out how can I get those things for free and then for low cost, and then if my cup still isn't full after doing those, then spending on other things without guilt in order to meet these needs. When I focus on the value first, the need first, then I'm ending up in like drive-throughs and mindless habitual like spending instances less. And I'm feeling better about the coffees and things that I do purchase more. And so that was the trigger that got me spending on things that I love and not feeling guilty about them when I was connecting them to something I valued.
I also love coffee, and we got the what was that, the Sip Club at Panera. Are you familiar with the Sip Club?
Yes, yes.
So for people that don't know, it's like when you pay for it, I think it may have been like $12 per month, and then it's unlimited hot drinks and cold drinks and whatever. You just go in there and you can get it like every 2 hours or something. And when you're on their email list, you'll get a promo for like a free little trial. And then if you try to cancel, they'll give you more free stuff. So have you gone that route mm-hmm. as well, where you're like, cancel?
Yeah. I've done several free trials of the Sip Club at Panera. Yeah.
And we live extremely, it's like about a mile away, so I could walk over there. So anyway, I did for a while, like get into a habit of it. So the thing is, a lot of times the coffee is like, it seems like it's watered down or it's like super inconsistent at my particular Panera over here. So eventually I kind of lost steam on it, but there's a great local coffee shop. So to your point, like it helps local economy. And if you can figure it out. So when you were mentioning it, I'm like, yeah, there were a couple of days where I was like, instead of getting the virtually free coffee or making it at home, it was like $4.50. And I'm like, oh man, that's actually not bad depending on where you're at. But yeah, I'm like, oh, $4.50. I could make like whatever, a whole pot of coffee for that. So I could relate to it. Okay.
I know.
So one thing, you know, we're talking about value-based spending here. Do you have a good way for people to figure out what their values are? Because like that is core to this. And when I think about it, even for myself, it's kind of fuzzy. It's really easy to go through your life, especially if you're busy working and you have all these other just responsibilities you have to deal with. You're not thinking like, does this meet my values? Do you have, like, we don't have a mission statement like right in front of us. So how do we figure out what we care about and why?
Yeah. So we developed a shortcut, and because we felt the same way, like it just felt too like out there, too woo woo. So we tried to find like, what's the foundation of human motivation? That's kind of where we started. And that's where we found Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So if you're unfamiliar, it's turned into this great meme on social media, but the original is a triangle with five levels. The first two are basic needs. So the first level is food, water, shelter, stuff like that. The second is safety and consistency. So those are our basic needs. And that's where a lot of personal finance information will stop. Like you need to be able to, or it will start there. Like you either need to be able to afford groceries, or we're just like, look, we already have groceries. Like, how do we just afford more groceries sort of stuff? So those are our basic needs. Where we find our values really lie is in these higher needs, because the thing about the hierarchy is that you don't start pursuing one after you fully meet the first need. You can, there's a difference between being hungry and not knowing where your next meal is coming from. So if you're thinking about that, then of course you're not going up the hierarchy. But if I'm hungry and I'm working on a really cool work project, I will be hungry for hours and continue working. So we will go up and pursue these higher needs on the hierarchy, even if the lower needs aren't met. So, and that's how we see a lot of people making like weird financial decisions on these higher needs, not realizing that that's where they're going. But so above our basic needs, we have our psychological needs. And the biggest base on that for these higher needs is relationships, belonging, connection, whether that's family, friends, love interests, all that right there. Above that, we have esteem. So that's self-esteem, self-confidence, feeling like you're respected by people who you respect, stuff like that. And then at the very tippy top, we have self-actualization, which is not like transcendence, like feeling you've reached nirvana or something like that. It's feeling like you are living into your full potential. So you're able to be creative. You're able to innovate, whether that's at work or in your personal life. You're able to be spontaneous. That is something that's so interesting, that spontaneity is one of our highest needs, yet impulse spending is villainized. And it's truly, impulse spending is not the enemy. It's what we're spending on. So it's all of these things that make us feel like we are an independent person living into our full potential. And so these are all the things that we want to pursue. These are the things that motivate us to act, motivate us to spend. And we found studies showed that for most people, at least in America, the biggest factors for motivation and for happiness were family, friends, faith, and fulfilling work. All on the hierarchy, all can meet various higher needs and basic needs in some capacity. So we've kind of distilled this hierarchy down into those four core values. We call them the four Fs because we love F words, frugal friends. That's where we start. If what we're spending on gets us at one or more of these four Fs, then we can be like really confident in our spending. And first of all, we like to try to spend time there first before we start thinking about spending money. But we don't want to do it at the expense of wasting time. So that's why we like to think of all of our resources when we think about spending. But we think of these four first, and if it's not one of those four, it can probably be found somewhere on the hierarchy, but it's kind of like an 80-20 rule. 80% of the time, it's going to be one of those four.
Can you give a quick example on how someone might spend time instead of money to test out that value?
For me, I will use groceries as an example, or food just in general. So I love food. I don't want to spend a lot of money on it. There are some people who love good food and want to spend money on it. But where my value lies in it is either getting with people, but also like not doing dishes. That's actually what I love most about eating. Eating out is not having to cook or do dishes. So for me, eating out is a time saver. And so while I will not spend money as much at a nicer restaurant, so that saves me a lot of money because I know what what I want is to be able to spend more time with my family or my friends. I have two young children, so it's usually my family, or spend more time doing work I love, instead of cooking or doing dishes. And so I will make room in my budget, my quote unquote budget that's not written down, to get usually like a quick service food or at the grocery store, pre-chopped veggies, which I know makes frugal people gasp. They're like, why wouldn't you just chop your own veggies? Because it takes time. And then I have to clean knives and cutting boards. So that's a way that I try to be a good steward of my time. And it still does play a little bit into the money when you're thinking, when I'm buying the free chopped vegetables, I'm still going to save more money than eating out. But I'm trying to think of all of these resources. And usually it is more, I'm taking the shortcuts at the grocery store because I also care about like the plastic and paper waste and all the food waste at restaurants. Like I'm not neurotic about it, but I do think about those things. It doesn't stop me from doing it 100% of the time. It does make me more conscious though. It's one of like my like real values. So.
Mm-hmm. And I love talking about food. I also love food. I enjoy, we're coming at it from completely different angles though. So I love cooking and the time that it takes to like chop the vegetable. I have a few like nice knives, and I grew up watching like the Food Network, and just it's a big part of what I like to do. We both enjoy food. Since I usually, we don't have any kids, side note. So we don't have any kids, but since I do most of the cooking, I typically don't do the dishes, right? As part of the trade-off mm-hmm. there. One thing I do allow myself to do is just when I am in the grocery store, I'll buy basically whatever I want because it's like, it's so much cheaper than going out. So for me, a lot of times it's like big, like really good steaks. And it took a little while because it is like dramatically more expensive to get like a prime cut versus other stuff. So one thing that I do is I often get the meat that's going to expire tomorrow. So it's marked down like 25%. And I like to go to Sam's typically on early like Monday morning or something like that. So if you have the plus membership at Sam's, you can go in at 8 mm-hmm. instead of 10. And then you actually get like a lot more selection. So that's like one little trick to save some money while still getting like really good meat and like spending time cooking and blah, blah, blah. Do you have other tips on saving money on food?
So many tips. But I love like what we both just described is the same like topic, but getting creative in our own ways. Because there are so many, there's blogs and articles, there's all kinds of things like 100 ways to save money on food, right? There's never going to be like, there's 1,001 ways to save on food. It really comes down to like getting creative with what feels like good stewardship of your time and what works for you in your season. So I love it. Let's see, food. Meal planning is so important to me. I especially creating realistic meal plans. Because sometimes Sunday Jen, who's making the meal plan, is not Wednesday Jen, who must then execute it. So Sunday Jen always has to consider Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday Jen. And so really realistic meal plans that reuse ingredients has been like, because food waste is such a big way that we waste our money. And it's not even like immediate. It's you're spending on it. It goes into the fridge and weeks later, then you remember and then you throw it away. So that's this slow burn that just like churns out money. So using the food is the best way to be efficient with your money. And for me, that has come down to like making these really simple, easy to execute and delicious. If I think the takeout sounds better than what I have to make at home, of course I'm going to want to go with the takeout because it's tastier. So like really prioritizing things that I like at home, not like making the healthiest or most efficient use of leftovers and ingredients. So finding that like radical middle has been life-changing.
Got it. One thing we started doing, so I do the grocery shopping too. I actually find that enjoyable because I know some people would be like, that's a waste of time. You could like put your order in ahead of time. But I like going through and picking the meat or whatever nonsense, right? So one thing that was happening is my wife was looking in the fridge and you have to hunt around. We're leftovers people, right? So we have lots of leftovers all the time. I know some people don't like leftovers. Mystery to me. I have no idea why.
But they exist. And we have a lot of episodes for those people because Jill lives with one.
Okay. So my wife was asking what's in here? I think it's old. I think we should throw it out. Just this year, I started labeling everything like a restaurant. So I put what it is and the date that it was prepared. So you just open the fridge and you see like the whole card catalog mm-hmm. of what we have in there. And you know, you need to eat it within a couple of days. You could prioritize it. And then, I mean, we didn't have much food waste before, but now it's like virtually zero because we know exactly what's in there and when mm-hmm. we should eat it by, which, you know, people do your own research, but maybe like 5 to 7 days if your refrigerator is nice and cold. But masking tape and a Sharpie, super easy. And then you don't have to hunt around. You just know where everything is in the fridge. Now, did you work in food service? Have you done that before?
Yes. I was a server and bartender. So I know FIFO, first in, first out. Yeah. And I kind of do that when I put away leftovers or I put anything away. I always put it in the back of the fridge. Everything in goes in the back. It pushes forward everything that's already in there. And we try to keep a pretty lean fridge so that I can see everything. And we have, one of the things I did on purpose was get a counter depth fridge so that it's not as deep. So I don't have the opportunity to fill it with as much. I know like some people love the idea of a huge fridge, but it was just like too much to manage for me. Even with like 4 people in my house, I still need to be able to see everything, or I do lose it. And I do currently have 2 bottles of Dijon mustard. Even with as much as I do this and talk about it, like, yeah, I have 2 bottles of Dijon mustard in my kitchen right now. So I just have to like create little barriers. Like I am consistently bowling through life and I need the bumpers up as much as possible.
Yeah, make it easy. Make it easy on yourself. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to kind of change directions here. There's a couple things I want to know. Number one, for the sound check, we talked about how much I don't want to interview people about books. So people should stick around for that. I hope it'll be very interesting. So I want to shift a little bit because writing a book is like a huge undertaking. So there's a couple things we want to get into, but I do want to thank our sponsors, or our one sponsor for today, and that is Ghostbed. And I have a Luxe mattress. It's fantastic. It's a little bit softer. And in this section, we're going to talk about sleep just a little bit. So do you sleep well, Jen?
I do. I go to bed exhausted and I love my bed. My 5-year-old comes in and he kicks me in the middle of the night. I refuse to leave it because I love my mattress so much.
Very good. And do you have like a good routine? Did you always sleep well? Like what's your secret? Because a lot of us, we have a hard time and it takes a little while to dial it in. So have you been a good sleeper traditionally?
I have been. And knock on wood, I feel like I got a little survivor guilt, you know, because I've always been a good sleeper and I love sleeping.
Yeah. So what is your sort of nighttime routine, getting ready for bed and all that? Or does it change every day?
Once we put the kids to bed, I climb into my bed and I'll either scroll, or currently I'm getting into embroidery. So I'm practicing embroidery in bed, and then 10 p.m. hits and lights are out. And I'm 35 years old, man. I can't, 10 p.m. is it for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We try to start wrapping up around 8:30 or so. It's wintertime when we're recording this. So it's like, it gets dark early and I'm like, mm-hmm. let's eat at 4:30. I'm like an old man. I'm like, let's eat at 4:30. Start wrapping up. It's dark outside. I need to get in bed.
Yes.
So, well, that's awesome that you are able to sleep so well. I think that embroidery stuff, it could be like meditation, right? It kind of lulls you.
Yes.
Up. Okay.
It's so much better than scrolling, doom scrolling on social media before bed.
Yeah, I try to keep the phone outside the room. Do you keep the phone outside? Do you let it charge elsewhere?
I keep it. I do keep it by my bed. I know it's debatable, but how good that is. But I use it as my alarm, and it's I know
it works for you. Yeah, yeah. No one's judging you out there. That's fine. Okay. Well, I mean, we'll try to learn what we can. But if some people just have sleep down, then there's less to,
I know.
There's less to learn. You're just good at it. Well, thanks to
Ghost. But I love sleep.
Yeah, I
still
do
love
too.
Learning.
And I love sleeping like longer. Naps are good if I need it. But yeah, we really do love the Luxe Bed. So people could check out Ghost Bed out there. You can save 50% using the coupon code MileHiFi, or you can go to ghostbed.com/MileHiFi. They have a sleep quiz. So if you're unsure which mattress to pick, you can go through. It takes about 3 minutes and they'll let you know which one is probably good for you. But they also have a 101 night at home sleep trial, so you could check it out. So thanks to Ghost Bed, and you can get to the link in the description. So, Jen, you wrote this book with your podcast partner, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Jill Siriani and I have been hosting Frugal Friends for almost 7 years at this point, and we spent the last year and a half writing this book.
Had either of you written a book before?
I self-published a few books. And my first one was called The No Spend Challenge Guide, and it's a consistent bestseller on Amazon, but it did not help me get this traditional book deal one iota. I actually wasn't allowed to talk about it or put it in the proposal at all.
You know, you start a podcast, there's no gatekeepers anymore, so it's silly they're trying to do it. You're like, I'm putting words in your mouth, but it's like, I'll sell my own books. You're doing podcast, like you're doing other stuff. Like you're selling your own mm-hmm. books. So it's silly. They think they have the monopoly on that. Okay. So what was it like writing with Jill?
Oh, okay. So this was definitely the most difficult thing we've ever done as business partners. We think we have so many of the same like ideologies about frugality and personal finance, but we come at them from different backgrounds. So mine is in the, you know, financial writing, journalism part. She's a licensed clinical social worker. So hers is from the mental health part. And she also came into the podcast not really knowing much about personal finance, just she was on a journey to pay off debt. And I came in kind of being like, what are we doing this? Why are we starting the show together? This is not a good pairing. And we just wanted to help her husband get a job in podcast production. So that's really why the show began. But it's over the years, we've just grown together. And we felt very passionate about saying the things we wanted to say in the ways we wanted to say them. So some of the headbutting came in me trying to change what she was saying or her trying to change what I said. But it was very minimal. And it was good for us to see that, like how we have the differing ways of saying things, because the magic in Frugal Friends really is the two of us together. Like when I go off and I had a blog before Frugal Friends and it was okay. But when I brought Jill into the podcast or when we started that together, like the questions just like opened up and I was able to think about things in such a different light. And it added like three dimensions to everything that was being produced. So that's what I feel this book is, a culmination of all those dimensions that are natural and that we have grown over the last 6 years. But there was a little headbutting, but it was healthy growth.
How did the actual writing get divided up? How did you tackle that?
We both felt passionate about particular things. So I am a real big geek on the history of marketing and how it has transformed capitalism over the last 100 years. And that so much of our consumption is not our fault. And so I had a fun time kind of starting back as far as the Industrial Revolution. And it's not like a history book by any means, but I did have fun doing that, which Jill, she enjoys it, but it's not where she geeks out. She wrote the chapter about community and curating your community to embrace old relationships, relationships that maybe are not the healthiest, but you can't get rid of, how to like grow relationships that are maybe more healthy for the season you're leaning into. She also wrote the chapter on embracing your season. So that's all like more her stuff. And then, you know, I wrote the one about the 80-20 rule on savings, where you focus on housing, transportation, and food that, you know, saves a little bit. It takes the pressure off of values-based spending when you're putting it in like this realistic light. So yeah, we just have different interests. And so that kind of naturally came.
Why didn't you self-publish this one?
We wanted a larger distribution. So if we were doing it for money, we for sure would have self-published. It would have been better. We did all of our own marketing. We didn't hire anyone. And it would have been kind of the same. But with a traditional publisher, you get a lot more eyes on the book. So like where we may have been able to afford one editor, we had about six people. We had a main editor, like copy editor, a couple proofreaders. We just had a lot of eyes on the book. And we really wanted outside opinions and insight to make it a collaborative effort. So it can help the most number of people. And then also wider distribution in places that we couldn't get in order to hopefully open even more doors in the future. So we were thinking like long-term strategies, what could be the best for us to grow this message as far and wide as possible.
So it sounds like you did a decent amount of research for the book. Did you learn anything along the way that made you change your approach to finances or values or anything?
Nothing that changed it. But even still, we finished writing the book in May, and it's December when we're recording this. Almost every time we do an interview, or I am like reading questions, and I'm like, dang it, I wish I put that in the book. So like the other day we were preparing for a talk. I don't know if you're familiar with Nerd Night. They do them in like various cities where just a couple of nerds do like a nerd funny style TED talk, is how I describe it. So we're giving one of those in 2 days, and we were doing our slides, and I was looking at Maslow's hierarchy of needs again. And lo and behold, in addition to all the other things I love in the self-actualization part, I learned that spontaneity is in there as well. And I was like, oh my gosh, we've been saying that impulse spending is natural, that it's okay as long as, you know, you plan for it, you can afford it, and you know that the impulse of spending is not on something that you don't value. And it's actually also in the hierarchy that's already in the book. So stuff like that, I just like little tiny things keep popping up that I'm still learning.
I didn't know spontaneity was in there either.
Yeah, I've read that a week ago. Wish I could have put it in the book. Would have tied together a few things very nicely.
So it sounds like you guys were able to work together pretty good. How long? So the podcast has been around for like 7 years. How long have you guys known each other?
Probably 8 years. We met each other a year before we started and had no plans to start a podcast together. But Jill and her husband and my husband, we just like clicked. We felt like a soul couple is what I kept saying. And they were living in an RV to save money on housing. And because they were living in that RV, they just decided to take a little road trip, like use the RV, whatever. They didn't buy it to travel. They truly bought it to save money on housing. But then they did a little traveling. And that's how we met them, is on one of their road trips from Pennsylvania down to Florida. And then they ended up moving here 2-3 years later. They moved here in 2020.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so it had to have been 3 years later.
That's cool. Well, as we're wrapping up here, we'll hit a couple other questions before we let people know where they can get the book and all that stuff. Like I said, in the sound check, people could hear my normal approach to interviewing around books and stuff. We rushed through a lot of stuff. You sent me a great prep guide, and I used a couple ideas from it. But is there any other big idea from the book that you want to share before we wrap up? It's okay if you don't have one. We want people to go check out the book. But is there anything that you think is important that we should mention here that's in the book that I didn't ask about?
I think if 5 people are anything like me, which I feel like we're in the group, I think I would still consider myself a part of the community in a different way. But I wanted to make this book so actionable for people who, like me, were a little hoardy with money. And we broke it up into 3 parts. So the first one is we define values and define spending as a skill. The second is we talk about all the geeky stuff that, you know, the 5 people are, it's just geeky. We're going to geek out together. But the third part is, I think, the most crucial part of the book, and it's don't go broke. Because some people can go broke with money, but other people go broke with their other resources. I know 5 people, we want to save time by retiring early or earlier, but sometimes it's at the expense of our current seasons in time. But even beyond that, the third part of the book is curating your environment to support any lifestyle changes you make. So whether that's financial or something that has nothing to do with money, like health or hobbies or habits, whatever, using this third part of the book where we talk about curating your community, your environment, and the bigger impact you have by choosing to live this lifestyle, I think that is going to impact people like way beyond money, like way beyond finances. And I'm so excited to hear how it changes people's perspective in areas of their life that they did not expect it to.
Who is this book for?
This book is for anyone who has either made a budget, you know, time and time again, month after month, and every single time is like, why can I keep the budget that I made? Whether that's they are overspending or underspending. And sometimes that leads to like guilt and shame and an idea that I'm just not good with money. I'm not good at spending. And sometimes that leads to an ideology of, you know, like I have to save because this is what successful people do. I think this will be for either of those people. I think it's the same person just using the money, same fears, using the money in different ways for the same fear.
And where should people buy this book?
You can buy it wherever books are sold. We love bookshop.org. You can support your local bookstores, and you can get that buywhatyoulovebook.com. We have links to all the major book retailers right there.
Perfect. We'll link up to that and make sure people can find it really easily. And where can people find you, Jen?
Frugal Friends Podcast, wherever you're listening to this show, whether it's YouTube or your favorite podcast player, we are on there twice a week.
Awesome. Well, very fun catching up with you. Good luck on the launch. I know you've been doing a ton of work over the past, you know, probably couple years, and you're out there on other podcasts trying to get out there. So I hope it goes really well.
Yes. I hope if you've heard us on another show that it's not a regurgitation. We try to make every single show unique in some way. And we just love hanging out with all our podcaster friends. It's why we did so many.
All right. Well, good luck on the launch, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High 5 podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number 1, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Traditionally, I don't like to interview people with books coming out. So I make rare exceptions for friends, genuine friends. So I was like, okay, we could do this, but you have a podcast. So you know, you probably get like what, 2 pitches per day from some author that you've never heard of, right? Yes. So this is a, like I said, big exception, but yeah, how do you handle all the incoming? I mean, people just want to get in front of your audience. They don't care about you at all. So how do you handle it?
Yeah. So this year was a little different because we knew that we had a book coming out. So we actually had a lot of authors on so that we could pick their brains. So in a strategic move, we had a lot of authors on this year. But also, I didn't want authors on because I didn't want to have the same episode come out as like 5 different shows at the same time. So we kind of tailor it to be, if it's a good book that's good for our audience, like we will have it, but I never go in having read the book. That is, I think the podcasting is kind of divided, right? Some people have to read it all and some people don't read anything. Even with doing these interviews, we've kind of, most don't read it, but we're in the camp that doesn't. I will die on that hill. But I love having authors on, just like to pick their brains, if nothing else.
Got it. Okay. Oh, great points. It's pretty tough, and you did it strategically to have those folks on. At first, there weren't as many authors, but now there's all these podcast marketing companies, so they spam it, and I'm just like, I mark it as spam and block. Like, I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I also think I typically don't read the book, or I'll skim it, or at least have an idea of what's going on. Of course, to ask some questions. But when other shows interview an author, I also don't like it when they just like read the chapter title and say, oh, what did you mean by that? It seems so lazy, and it's just a rehash of the book. So then I don't have to read the book. When I see other interviews come out from that author, I also skip those. So as a avid podcast listener, I generally don't like listening to those either. So it kind of wrecks the whole thing. And I don't know, I think people are divided. Now, as a listener, do you listen to a lot of podcasts?
Not actually. No. I listen to true crime podcasts, okay, which is why we do a few episodes a year that are like true financial crime. Oh, and right. I like that.
Okay. That makes sense too. Okay. And those shows are fun. What's your favorite true crime pod then?
I haven't listened to one in a while because I've been on an audiobook kick, but anything involving a cult. And like, I wish there was like a financial cult. The closest I think we can get is Nexium, but I would do a sub podcast on that in a heartbeat. Like, that would be my dream, like some kind of like financial money cult. I will say, we went on the Sounds Like a Cult podcast. That was one of my dreams. And that was a strategic move when the host had a book come out in April. I invited her on the show.
All right.
And then she ended up bringing us on her show. And the episode was about the cult of Dave Ramsey. So I don't think I would do a full podcast series on that because I don't want to die, but it was one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done.
That's good. That's a good way to like fold your two interests together. And mm-hmm. Great idea. Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.